All right.
All right. Well, I'm recording, so I guess we just get started. What are we talking about? I don't know.
Well, you want to talk about Red and Rebel, right? Rebel and Red?
Yeah.
I first found Rebel in 98, I think. And yeah, it's been, so what's that, 20 plus years, and still nobody knows about the language. It's a fantastic language, and now there's the Red effort, which I think is really kind of carrying the torch. I don't think there's like a life left for the original Rebel, so to speak. I mean, it's a you can use it for things, but like for going forward.
Yeah.
I think Red is the way to go. It's an unfortunate name, in my opinion, because Googling, it makes it harder to Google.
Yeah, it does. You have to do Red-Lang or Red language. But what was it about? I mean, presumably when you first discovered Rebel, you pretty quickly realized how powerful it was, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're any of the little introductory pages to it kind of blow you away, the way that there's so many data types, the way that networking and so many things are built in. You don't have to include something and figure out how to, it's just part of the language. And so many things are really polymorphic, or not polymorphic, so to speak. They mimic each other or whatever, just like in the old, you know, the original Unix stuff, that design of, you know, everything's standard in, standard out, standard error, and you can pipe things by building on that. It's sort of the same thing, where reading a file is the same as reading an email, is the same as reading a URL in Rebel. Yeah. And seeing just, you know, read URL, read file name, read, you know, my mailbox, and being able to process things like, oh, well, this is just like doing that.
Yeah.
And then the language itself, you know, looking so lispy, and not just because of the, you know, the look, so to speak, but the real homo iconicity,
homo iconicity.
The code being data and data being code, and that, you know, Rebel program is just a block of tokens and other blocks of tokens inside. And blocks are the main data structure in Rebel.
Yeah. And what were you working with at the time? What kind of programming were you doing at 98?
I was working on the mainframe, doing assembler and C at Storage Technology.
Okay.
And yeah. It was kind of the first time that we'd actually been able to get onto the internet at work. That when I had that job, it was the first job I had had where being on the computer got you anywhere outside of the building, really. Yeah. Except for being able to read files. I don't know how I ran into it, but you know, when I think one of the big things that impressed me too right away was, like, even at the time, it ran on something like 16 or 20 platforms without changing the scripts. And the fact that what makes it run is a single executable that ranges between 200 and 500K.
Yeah.
And that's it. You know, yeah. You go to install Rebel, and that means download this 500K executable, you're done.
And that hasn't changed a whole lot in the last 20 years.
No.
Everything is getting bigger and more bloated, and that, I think that's still somewhere around a meg, if you want to.
Yeah, it's that. A tiny little executable, and that says something. I mean, the fact that there's more built into the language than any other language, really.
Yeah.
Built into the language itself. And yet all of that is contained inside this tiny executable. It's not because they figured out how to squish bits together tighter.
they removed the zero.
They removed all the zeros. You know, it really, that said something to me, that somehow the way the language is interpreted is built in a layered system so that things are very reused and very compact and very efficient, and it is very efficient. It's very fast.
Yeah. Had you any experience with any kind of Lisp at that point, to that point?
I think I had seen Lisp, you know, in books, and that was it.
Yeah.
I remembered like Carr and Kutter.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think. And, you know, in that parse, when you're early on in Rebel, you run into the parse dialect that's built in. And that's, you know, that's another thing. Everything's a dialect. Even the language itself is the, at least for Rebel, was, I forget what they called it, but it was basically, this is the executable dialect, so to speak. But there's all kinds of dialects, and they're just domain-specific languages that are so easy to define because of that parse thing that they have.
Right.
But you can, you know, there's so many one-liner examples of it that just really blow your mind. Because it wasn't mainstream, one of the unfortunate things is, you know, there isn't support for things that you would want support for sometimes.
Like what?
Well, like the HTTPS.
Yeah.
I can get and I can post to those URLs, but like writing a web server in Rebel is just a couple, you know, just a few lines, opening a port and listening. But I can't create an SSL web server with Rebel.
Yeah.
And as soon as you start even just playing around in the corporate environment, you know, if you're just trying to write some scripts to automate some stuff for yourself, that can be a problem.
Yeah.
But
that's, you know, the hope is that Red will solve those problems, right? When Red gets to 1.0, I don't think they're at 1.0 yet. When it gets to 1.0, it'll have all of those facilities that Rebel, and really Rebel has had all of that, right? I mean, that's not been a problem with Rebel. It's just that you had to pay for it.
Some of the stuff, early Rebel, you couldn't, I don't think you could even execute like a system command from within the code. You had to buy the Rebel command language.
Right.
Then they opened that up to where you could execute stuff in your environment from within the script. It got more and more open, and yeah, Red needs to just make sure they address all of, you just can't have any showstoppers. You've got to figure out what a large percentage of the development is using and say, you know, we got to make sure we supply that stuff.
Right. Which I think it's on the product roadmap. I was just going to look at the product roadmap to see. So like the Red system compiler is 100%. That's in Rebel. Red system linker in Rebel is 100%. The Red runtime in Red system, because right now it's bootstrapped off of Rebel. Red needs Rebel still, but I think the goal is so that it's sort of self-hosting. It doesn't need Rebel anymore. And that's about 95%, it looks like. File IO is pretty close. It's at 90%. Network IO, there's kind of what you were talking about with HTTPS. It's only at 20%, so they got a lot of work to do there. It looks like they've made a lot of progress with GUI support. It's at 60%. But it's not that they're not so self-hosted. It's got self-hosted, rewrite Red system compiler in Red. I think they have to get a lot of this other stuff done first before it can be self-hosted. And then rewrite the Red compiler, both AOT and JIT in Red. No progress on either one of those. IA32 code backend is 100%. PIC support is 100%. ARM V5 is 100%. AVR, I'm not sure what AVR is. Looks like the plans are to target the JVM and the CLR at some point. And that's what fascinates me so much about Red, is the way they're building it. You'll be able to compile I mean, it's true, write, write once, run anywhere. You know, the way, because Java, if you remember, used to pitch that. That was their big, that was their big selling point, especially early on. Write once, run anywhere. Well, the way they did that is they had a virtual machine. Nothing wrong with that. You've got JVM, you've got CLR, you've got LLVM that does all that. But what's interesting to me about Red is it does it differently. There's no virtual machine. When you compile a Red program to a native binary, it is a native binary. It's running at that low level. There's no virtual machine sitting in between. So you get a lot, of speed benefits. You get a lot of compatibility just baked right in by doing that.
But you can run it in the other mode too, where it's, you know, essentially being interpreted.
Yeah. And that's the goal for the JVM, the CLR, all of that. They obviously want that, want to do that. It's just, you don't have to. I mean, if you want to compile a native x86 binary, if you want to compile a Linux binary and a Windows binary, setting aside Windows subsystem for Linux, you could do that. And it would be a native Windows and or Linux binary.
Yeah. Well, there was a thing for a while in Rebel that Carl Sassenrath, the inventor, was calling the X internet, the executable internet, because Rebel scripts are so small. I mean, shockingly small.
Yeah.
And because programs are data, it's just a block of tokens again, you can very easily open, be listening on a port and have a block of script posted to you and and just execute it.
Right.
And that was his dream, was passing these little mini scripts around and saying, I need you to execute this. And, you know, of course, the security concerns are addressed in the way that that code is executed and evaluated. But just the idea that you're not going through some kind of a weird handshaking transformation process and any of that kind of stuff. You're just saying, here, execute this.
Yeah.
And it's just so, there's so much that's seamless in Rebel.
And that can, and the transport mechanism for that, because of the simplicity, can be HTTP if you want, but it could just be low-level TCP/IP if you want. It could be a straight connection, because you're just schlepping that code to somewhere else and telling them to execute it, right?
Mm-hmm.
How you schlep it across the wire to them is immaterial. Yeah, I remember, because when I first discovered Rebel, it was actually a friend of mine, shout out to Chris Freiberger, who told me about it. And when I first looked at it, the big selling point, the way it was being pitched was that executable internet, but more specifically was agents, because there was a period, and it was about a year after you had discovered it. It was like a year or two after you had discovered it. When I discovered it, and agents were for a brief time a big thing. I'm not sure anybody ever actually sort of defined what an agent was, but that's what everybody was talking about for about a 6-month period during that time. And I think the Rebel guys, Carl and those guys, had realized what a perfect language to build agents with. And I guess that kind of ties fairly closely in with the executable internet in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it seemed cool, but I wasn't. I mean, I was still fairly new in my programming career at that point, so I couldn't appreciate the language for what it was at the time. It wasn't until probably 10 years later, after you and I had met and you started talking about it, that then I could appreciate the simplicity of it.
Now, of course, there are interesting aspects. It's, I imagine that it's harder to learn for a very experienced programmer compared to somebody new. That's what I found. I mean, I can't really say what it would be like new, but I've seen people who were less experienced programmers look at it and pick it up, and it, because it goes against what I call all the C-based languages, which covers a whole lot of them. You know, anything with curly braces, essentially,
yeah,
the C language. And that's what so many people are used to at this point. I mean, everything from PHP to Java, they're all the same. They have all the same control structures. You're going to find a switch and a case in every one of them. And all that comes from C. But, you know, you get into Rebel and it's like, this is completely different. There is an if statement. There is a loop. There are a few things. There are some control structures that you're familiar with, but then the way that they're done is different a lot of times. And the way that you do, the way you break a problem down starts to become different with Rebel. Yeah. And I mean, I think that was, we were talking, Cynthia and I talked with Brandon Stewart, was the tools shape the thinking to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the way we look at programming tasks and a lot of stuff that's grown up around programming, frameworks, build processes, all that stuff is partially controlled by a mindset that's subconsciously controlled by the language that we're using.
Right.
And you really, you can start to think differently when you, I mean, anybody who's a Lisp programmer or who knows a Lisp programmer knows that they see things, that they see programming differently. You know, they can. And
I think Eric S. Raymond of the Cathedral, I think he's famous for the Cathedral and the Bazaar, among other things. In one of his writings, he says you should go learn Lisp, even if you never learn Lisp, or even if you never use Lisp again, it will change the way you think. It'll make you a better programmer. And you know, I think it's easy to extrapolate from that. You should learn a Lisp, a homoiconic programming language like Rebel, Red, Clojure, Scala, whatever, because it does change the way you think. I mean, interestingly, knowing Rebel, knowing Red, knowing Clojure has actually changed the way I write my JavaScript. But going back to what you were saying before, that aspect of experienced programmers have a tougher time picking Rebel and Red up. That actually seems to apply to almost any homoiconic language because it's just so different. And I think you and I both have experienced situations where we'll do something in Red and or Rebel, and we'll realize we just did in 10 lines what could have been done in one, because we're so used to having to do that. We're so used to having to write 10 lines of PHP code or JavaScript code to achieve this simple thing that is trivial in Rebel.
Yeah,
I would like to see that. I've thought about trying to teach my kids Rebel. I think it would help me learn it a little bit better. But I also would like to observe them picking it up and see how much quicker they pick it up, given that they don't have any programming experience whatsoever. But then I could be dooming them, right? I could be dooming them by teaching them this wonderful language, and then they get to college and their CS professor says, okay, are you ready to learn Java now? So now the whole course, they're going to be going, what is this? Why do I have to do this? You do this in one line in this other language. Why are you making me write this crap?
Well, all it takes is, I mean, it takes a certain critical mass with a language, right?
Yeah. You've got
a certain number of people to start using it, and maybe the right vocal people too. And yeah, basically it just needs to catch on.
Right.
You're like, because I don't think there's anything you can knock against it other than, well, it's hard to learn. Yeah, it is.
But once you get it, you get it. Once you have, and there's all these light bulb moments that you have with a language like that.
Well, I have to go back and relearn it a lot. I feel like it's, you know, a hard language, but that's to go the other direction is a never-ending quest. I mean, that's why we have the frameworks and the continuous automated what have you, is not because we're improving software development, because the success of software development has improved ever. We're making up for lack of skill from the person who's doing the job. We're trying to build that skill into the process as much as possible, so we don't have to rely on the people having the skill. But it seems like some of these novel ideas that, you know, that I've been thinking is like, well, that's kind of the whole crux of the problem, is go back to the shit that's hard and keep learning it and keep getting better at it, because the product that you make with it is a better product.
Yeah.
What you create with it is better. It's just so funny in a way. It's sort of like, oh, I have to get better. Oh no, I'm going to use different tools.
Right.
Versus this is a great freaking tool, but it is for an artisan. It is for a trained, you know, it is for somebody who knows their stuff, baby. And so what, you know, then it's like, okay, keep improving my game. You know, that just made me think about, you know, like a sport or something. I mean, if you can't make up for, or making up for the lack of skill, trying to make up for the lack of skill with a tool doesn't always work anyways in any area.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think it's better to work on you getting better as a personal resource. I've been doing all that development with SQL, and I find that, yeah, doing things in SQL is a lot less straightforward than doing them in a programming language a lot of times. Mm-hmm. But when I'm done, it's so fast, it's so small, there's no extra stuff around it. There's just a couple SQL statements.
Right.
And everything's done. It's a much better thing that you're creating, rather than something with 800,000 files and building and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that here we are, arguably, what, 60 years into software engineering, 70 maybe, somewhere around there. But I don't know. We could say 60 years, because you figure BASIC and those languages were created in the 50s. Lisp was created in the 50s. And arguably, software development is getting harder. And I don't understand how we as an industry aren't taking a step back and going, that shouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
Software development is getting harder. We're getting more and more tools around our software development. You can't just, you know, when you and I got started in web development, you needed a browser and a text editor and an FTP client. And that was it. Now, that wasn't great, but that's all you need. Those are the three tools you needed to build a web page. And now you need, and I calculated, you also had, HTML. Okay, sure, you had JavaScript, but it was hardly used at the time. I think when I got started, you didn't have CSS. CSS didn't really hit the scene until about 98, 99. So HTML, CSS, will include JavaScript, and then a back-end language if you want to do any kind of dynamic processing. So we'll say PHP or Perl. So you have four languages. I think I calculated we're up to about six now, because you're doing TypeScript. But if you do TypeScript, you have to know JavaScript, because it compiles down to JavaScript. And then you need HTML. And then oftentimes the HTML will get, you'll have something like Jade, things like that. So that sits on top of HTML, that compiles to HTML. And then you have CSS, but most CSS, or I won't say most, but oftentimes CSS has a layer on top of it, which is SAS, SCSS and SAS. And then you have the backend, which could be JavaScript and or TypeScript. So you're looking at 6 to 7 different languages alone to build an application. And then, like you said, you have continuous development, continuous delivery, continuous integration tools. You've got Docker, Kubernetes, all of these things just to build a web application. how is this getting better? And then you look at things like Rebel, where you just, you have the language. You just write, you solve the problem, and you're done. You don't need any of these other things. To me, that's telling. To me, that's telling that we, as an industry, are going in the wrong direction. But on the flip side, I don't know how we get that critical mass that you talked about. I don't know how we get enough people. I think there's a groundswell towards that with functional programming. Clojure is a big one. It's getting a lot of attention. Although everybody in Clojure complains about the parentheses, which is ironic because there's really no more parentheses in Clojure than there is, or Lisp than there is in other languages, but it seems like there is. And maybe the problem is what we talked about earlier, which is people are set in their ways. People know the C-based languages, and it's tough for them to pick up the functional languages. Did you ever watch that video, Simple But Not Easy, by Rich Hickey, the guy that created Clojure?
I don't remember.
That's the one where he talks about guardrail programming. It's a fantastic talk that he gives, and talking about the complexity of software development, in modern software development. And for anybody that's watching this, I highly recommend going and watching that, because it's like a revelation of, we've for too long equated complexity with quality in software development. And I know that has always been a big thing, that Carl Sassenrath has sort of championed, that complexity is not good. Complexity in our software is not good. And that is something that Rebel and Red are both actively fighting against. I would love more if more people could appreciate that.
Well, that fits that, like that SQL only or SQL mostly model that I've been trying out. Same kind of thing, is the simplicity in and of itself is a benefit, not just, you know, aesthetically. It's a benefit in terms of maintaining that software and running that software. The overhead, I mean, when you're, you know, there are some things I'm sure that can't be helped right now, like the mobile development. There's a lot of translation that has to go on that's controlled by the platforms that the various manufacturers chose. Whenever you're running a project and, you know, you build it and you wait 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, 10 minutes for all this stuff to go on, it does add up a lot.
Yeah.
And I think to trivialize that or minimize that is just, you know, it's a lie. You watch people. I've been in environments where you really couldn't make much progress because the process took so long. And there were several sub processes that each took time.
That project I worked on about 3 years ago. I don't want to name their names because it's a great company, but it would sound like I'm negging on them, and I'm not. I'm negging on Angular. It was an Angular project where I realized, because of all the compilation and the shaking of the trees and all this other nonsense, I would save the change. The file watcher would see the save, kick off that compilation process, and then refresh in the browser. And there was a 10-second delay between when I would save a change and when I would see that change in the browser. Mm-hmm. And I added it up based on the hourly rate that we were billing them. And it was thousands of dollars a year that they were wasting simply because they chose to use Angular. And at the time I said, how is this better? How is this better than what we used to have? It's a rhetorical question because nobody ever seems to have an answer for that.
I can't remember how it was said, but, you know, it's something that has kind of always driven me. And this one, going back to Rebel, one of the things that appealed to me was, this is different. Nobody's using this. Nobody knows about this. It's extremely different.
Yeah.
And the thought I was getting at that somebody expressed was, if there's an opinion that the vast majority hold, it's more often than not the wrong thing.
Yeah.
You can't come to the conclusion that something is valuable because it's popular.
Right.
I.e. Taylor Swift. E.g. Taylor Swift, excuse me. You know, there's a lot you can point at that's popular with a huge amount of the population, but you look at it and you say, nope, there's no there.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is what's going on with this stuff as well. Now we use Angular because there's so many Angular developers. Why are there so many Angular developers? Well, because there's so many people who want Angular developers. You know, it's a self-fulfilling thing, and it's just a matter of catching on. Like I said, with Rebel, I mean, if you got this one shop that was making good money doing projects, and they hired Rebel people, there'd be a few people that would start getting involved in that. Well, it'd start to get out that, well, you want a job here, you need to know Rebel. What's Rebel? I think that's all it takes, is getting the right toehold in somewhere, and then it kind of generates itself. But the only way that can happen really is if the language at least can support itself. Is the language viable? And if it is, then yeah, it would be great to see that happen, because I mean, everything that we've seen about these languages, those two languages so far, is that they're a whole different thing. And maybe if there was a critical mass of implementations using them, we'd see something in that, in the aggregate. Better performance on the web, better performance on our computers. You know, who knows?
Yeah. And for me anyway, I don't know about you, but for me, that's kind of a goal of this podcast, is to help popularize Rebel and Red. Because I think we need a few things. Well, number one, the obvious thing we need is Red to get to a 1.0 version. I would have expected it to get there by now, but they don't, I mean, you know, they're limited in their resources. So anyway, we got to get to that point. I think another thing we need when we get to that point, or maybe sooner, maybe we can do that with Rebel and Red, is, I don't know if you remember, but back around 2005, I think it was around 2005, David Heinemeier Hansen did this video showing how to build a to-do list app with Ruby on Rails, and it just blew up. Everybody was just excited. Look how easy it is to build this. All you have to do is configure these few things, run this command, it scaffolds the whole thing, and then you can make some changes from there. You're good to go. I think we need that moment with Rebel and Red. We need to show how easy it is to build an application in Rebel and maybe Red. It can't be a to-do list. I don't know what it needs to be, but it needs to be a video that people can come away from watching it with that aha moment. Wow, look at this. This is really powerful. It gets them excited and makes them want to learn the language even more. I had another thought of what else we need, and I can't remember what it is now. But I think we need those kind of things to get the word out.
Well, this is the start.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything more to say today about it.
You're all out. Okay. No, that's cool. I think this is a good first episode. So
we're going to need to be able to get some video.
You need to get some video? What do you mean?
We're going to need to be able to get some video. I mean, if you want to talk about programming languages, I think people are going to want to see.
Yes.
If possible.
Yeah. I think that's what we need to try to focus on with this podcast, is showing off the language.
Yeah, especially with Rebel. I mean, you don't, it's hard. You know, you can describe it all you want, but until somebody sees you doing something that normally would take 10 lines and you do it in half a line.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Wow.
One of the things we should find and show is somewhere on the in the Rebel documentation, I think it was in a blog post that Carl did a while ago, where he showed how you can write a Rebel parser in 10 lines of Rebel.
Yeah.
Which just blows me away. And it's not... on the one hand, it's amazing. On the other hand, it's like, well, you know, whatever. But when you stack that against other languages, writing a JavaScript parser in JavaScript is orders of magnitude more lines of code than 10, and probably just about any other C-based language. To me, what that really does is it highlights the efficiency of Rebel.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 10 lines of code, you can see, and I'm trying to think, you could probably do, I guess why it's not as amazing maybe as it seems on the surface is you can probably do the same thing with just about any functional programming language, any Lisp. But so maybe it's not highlighting the efficiency of Rebel, it's highlighting the efficiency of that style of programming.
All right.
So, okay, well, until next time.